It's Monday morning. My name is Jeff Humfeld. Welcome to Jaws of Justice Radio. On today's edition, attorney Robin Martinez hosts a discussion with KC area criminal defense attorney and former Wyandotte County prosecutor Brian Leiniger about the militarization of our police force. Then, in the second half of our show, host Allie Catherine Bush will have three guests on to talk about the community behavioral health care services offered by the Wyandotte Center Crisis Clinic. Get your pens and paper ready for our calendar of events in the middle of the show, and as always, the 420 drug war news after the show. Now, here's Robin and Brian.
Good morning, everybody. This is Robin Martinez. I'm a member of the Kansas City chapter of the National Lawyers Guild and a member of the law firm Martinez, Madrill & Machacow. Today, you're listening to Jaws of Justice Radio on KKFI 90.1 FM. Our topic is the militarization of police forces in the United States. And my guest here today with me in the studio is Brian Leiniger. Brian's an attorney who does a lot of criminal defense work here in the Kansas City metropolitan area. Welcome to the show, Brian.
Thank you, Robin.
Militarization of police has become a topic that seems like it's been getting a lot more press lately, with a lot more people having access to cell phone cameras and video cameras. We're starting to see a lot more of what actually happens in a lot of police raids. And it seems like over the past few years, there have been a lot more videos that have gone viral of heavily armed SWAT teams kicking people's doors in. Is this something that's just brand new, or is it something that's been there for a while, or what's the history? Why have the police gotten so militarized and almost looking like they're armies in third world countries?
Well, it's definitely not brand new. It's been around, I'd say, started with the drug war maybe 40 years ago, or really started increasing then. But it's certainly been around a while. I was a prosecutor in the inner city in Wyandotte County in the early 90s. It was certainly alive and well then. I was a young man and went out on a lot of drug raids and stayed in the background while they were doing that very thing over, generally small amounts of drugs. But I think it's just increasing. It's becoming a lot more prevalent. More and more police agencies, and especially smaller towns and smaller police agencies, are getting or have had SWAT teams for a while and are using them a lot more often. If they're going to have them, they're going to use them. So I just think it keeps growing and growing. Now, you're right that it's harder to hide now. Everybody's got a video camera on their cell phone, and it is coming to light a lot more. And I think the opposition to it is really growing because people are seeing what actually happens. And obviously, it's shocking.
What do you think has been driving that trend?
It's really hard to say. I mean, I think the war on drugs really probably started it, but that was a long time ago, 40 years, and it's been a slow growth since then. The best I can figure is the police like doing it. It's a lot more exciting and a lot more to brag about with their families and friends than writing speeding tickets or investigating auto burglaries or something boring like that. They really get into it. They love the toys that they get from the, especially military surplus with the tanks and armored vehicles and the armor they wear when they're breaking down people's doors. I think, they get a taste of it. They like it more, and it just continues to grow.
Now, when I was looking at some of the types of equipment that local police departments are getting, I ran across a reference to a very small police department in a small town out in Rhode Island that only has a population of maybe about 28,000 people in the town. And apparently they wound up getting 30 M16 rifles, over 600 M16 magazines with over 18,000 rounds of ammo, 44 bayonets, and 12 Humvees, all from federal law enforcement grants going to local law enforcement agencies. What on earth would a local, a small town police force need that many Humvees and bayonets and M16s for?
Well, of course they don't. Rhode Island is a, and it doesn't just happen that it's Rhode Island. It's everywhere. But they, obviously, as a small town in a tiny little state, if they needed something like that, they could call on somebody nearby. They could have possibility of something like this every 100 miles or something rather than every little town. But, of course, that's just ridiculous.
Have we seen that happen here in Missouri as well, where even in Missouri and Kansas, small law enforcement agencies are loading up on this type of equipment?
Absolutely. It's easy for them to get. It's military surplus. They get it free a lot of times, or they buy it with the money they've seized through civil asset forfeiture. But, yeah, it's just as common here in the middle of the country as it is anywhere else.
Now, I always, anytime I see something like that, I always try to follow the money because I usually find that money seems to lie at the root of virtually everything. To what extent have grants from the federal government maybe led to or fueled this crazy acquisition of all of this paramilitary equipment by police forces?
I think to a very large extent. It's really, I don't think it could exist without that. And, you know, we could get far afield here, but I think the defense contractors want to keep selling things. The government wants to keep them happy for whatever political reasons. They want to get rid of they have to get rid of the old stuff to buy new stuff, so they grant it or sell it very cheaply to these police agencies who are enamored with it and snatch it up.
Now, one of the items that I ran across was something called the Byrne Grant Program that the federal government has. And I understand that back, in fact, going back through most of the Clinton years while he was the president, annual funding was about $500 million a year that was going to essentially pay for this kind of equipment for local law enforcement agencies. And then it dropped down almost to about $170 million a year during the Bush administration. It suddenly exploded again with the Obama administration with over, you know, $2 billion being funneled to, you know, through this grant program. Why do you have any thoughts at all on maybe why that program is so popular and why the federal government is just pouring that much money into the local law enforcement agencies?
Well, the first time I heard about that or read about that, I was very surprised that, I mean, you might think it would have been the other way around with the Democrats not being so in love with it and the Republicans more, but it seems to be the other way around for whatever reason. I don't know the root of it. I could only speculate on the political reasons, and I suspect that's what it would be political reasons to keep political factions happy, but it does seem strange that it's Obama kicked it up so high.
Now, a lot of that has come about with the whole growth in the Homeland Security Department or the Homeland Security Agency. Is that also your understanding?
Yeah, I think all this stuff really kicked into gear after 9/11 when Homeland Security was formed, and obviously tensions were high and everybody thought they needed to be prepared for a terrorist attack. I think people have calmed down a lot since then, but the police agencies certainly don't want to give up their expensive war toys.
Well, one of the things I found that was really kind of interesting was back in 2008, I was reading about a potential cut in these grant fundings going to the local law enforcement agencies. And one of the interesting things that happened was that various drug task forces across the country decided to hold a major public relations blitz, and they did a whole series of coordinated drug raids that they were using to highlight how effective these grants were. And apparently, in Kentucky alone, in a 24-hour period, the police then uncovered like 23 meth labs, you know, over a couple tons of marijuana, and arrested nearly 600 people in a 24-hour period as part of a big PR blitz. Does it seem strange to you that they can suddenly all of a sudden discover all of these things going on to basically make a political point?
Well, I suppose it should, and it would to most people, but nothing really surprises me anymore. Yeah, you would think if they knew about the existence of 24 meth labs, they would have gotten on them sooner than waiting for a political opportunity. I suppose meth labs in Kentucky are not very hard to find, back then especially, but even today and in most of the country, for that matter. But it certainly shows that they're not above being opportunistic.
You're listening to Jaws of Justice Radio on KKFI 90.1 FM. This is Robin Martinez. I'm a member of the Kansas City chapter of the National Lawyers Guild. And with me today is Kansas City criminal defense lawyer Brian Leininger, and we are talking about militarization of the police forces across the country and also here in Missouri and Kansas as well. We've talked about the tremendous growth in the use of sort of military equipment and paramilitary forces by local law enforcement agencies. I'm presuming some things can go radically wrong when you have very heavily armed police for what should be routine law enforcement operations. I mean, have there been some examples around of things that have been botched or uses of power that have occurred because of this?
Absolutely, and it happens all the time. Some very common things would be the police would get a search warrant and they'd get their paramilitary force together to knock the door in, and they routinely and frequently get the wrong house. So they'll bust down the door and come in screaming in their full armor, and there will be some poor person sitting there not knowing what's going on. There have been a lot of circumstances where those people have had heart attacks, or those people think they're being the victim of a home invasion and don't know who these masked people are coming in and pull a gun, with the result, obviously, that they get shot a million times by the officers coming in. Absolutely innocent people. That's bad enough. Even if they're raiding the house they intended to raid, some of those people will pull a gun to defend their 4 grams of marijuana or whatever that are in the house, and or because they think they're being raided, you know, or robbed, and they will get killed. Recently, I just read this the other day. This happened a while ago in Texas. The police kicked in the door and came in. The homeowner thought he was being burglarized and robbed, and he pulled a gun and shot and killed one of the officers, went to a grand jury and tried to indict that man for murdering the officer, and the grand jury said no, which was very surprising and a great result, I think. They thought, they totally believed, the grand jury did, that this man reasonably thought he was being robbed and reasonably shot at the people coming in. Now, it's a shame that that officer was killed. It's one more result, a needless death in this circumstance. And again, in that case, they found a little bit of marijuana in the house or something. And then another thing just recently in Ankeny, Iowa, just up the road a couple of hours, this one got some national press. The Ankeny is a town on the outskirts of Des Moines. It's a small town, but they had a SWAT team. They wanted to go in, and I think they were looking for somebody who was producing fraudulent credit cards or something. Instead of knocking on the door and looking for it, they broke the door down and went in there, and I think they shot the family dog and tore up the house, and again found very little evidence of crime. It happens all the time.
So that really seems that it's really a proportionality issue. I mean, is there any justification for the police to come in that type of a manner, that heavily armed, as opposed to just simply knocking at the door with a warrant?
Occasionally there is. If they have knowledge or good belief that the fellow who just robbed the bank and shot the bank guard is hiding out in there, I think, you know, that's a pretty good use of something like that. Or if they think a major criminal is in there, they've got good evidence that that person would be willing to defend himself with lethal force, then I think that's the time that this sort of thing would be used. But that's very rare, and that doesn't happen very often. Every little town has this force, and if they have it, they're going to use it. So they use it in circumstances where all they had to do is knock on the door, you know, police search warrant, and they'll either get let in or they can then enter the place. But there aren't that many circumstances where that type of force is necessary or should be used, so they use it in a lot of circumstances where it shouldn't.
Now, you mentioned the grand jury that refused to indict the homeowner who shot the police officer during one of these raids. Are we maybe starting to see a situation where maybe the courts or the public is maybe starting to look a little bit more critically at how the police are conducting their activities?
I think so, in some circumstances anyway. Like we mentioned, that things that used to be done in secret and hidden from public view can't be hidden anymore because of the fact that everyone has a video camera in their pocket, and a lot more things are being videoed now that used to go unknown. So I think a lot more people are becoming aware of the horrors that are created by this. I think the fact that it was a grand jury means a lot, too. It's a bunch of citizens who can see it and be reasonable about it. Most of these cases are taken to the local prosecutor who works with the local police departments every day, and the last thing that prosecutor is going to do when an officer is shot is say, no, I think it was justified, I'm not going to prosecute. The prosecutor is always going to charge that case. This happened to be a grand jury and made up of local citizens, and they are not as biased as the prosecutor would be.
Well, that's interesting, because a lot of the times we hear that the grand jury process is very susceptible to abuse. The old joke being that you could get a grand jury to indict a ham sandwich.
In this case,
it seems to have actually worked out in favor of the citizens.
It did, and I don't know the political background of that particular case. Sometimes the prosecutor doesn't want to be in the position of making that decision. If he thought it was justified but didn't want to upset the police department that he works with every day, he could have maybe taken it to a grand jury to protect himself. Or another similar thing would be to bring in a special prosecutor to make that decision so he or she wouldn't have to do it. I don't know the background of that case. Yeah, I mean, that is the old joke that a grand jury would, if the police and prosecutors want an indictment, they're going to do it. So I think they saw exactly what happened here, and it worked well.
Now, one of the other topics that we've looked at when it comes to the militarization of the police is not just what they're doing in individual raids, but I know on this show we've had a number of other discussions where we've talked with guests about the use of a very militaristic type tactics against people trying to express their First Amendment rights and against protesters. Do you have any particular thoughts on how the militarization of the police may affect people's individual rights of expression and First Amendment rights?
Well, it seems to me that that sort of abuse has become a lot more prevalent since the police agencies have taken on a more militarized view. As I certainly remember when I was young, and I bet you do too, we thought of police officers as being our friends and as being the people we would turn to if we were in danger. I find myself in the position now of I don't tell my kids to not talk to police or avoid police, but that's not the first place to look when you're in if you need help. If my teenage sons are pulled over for a traffic ticket, my first thought is, okay, now they're going to shake them down looking for drugs or looking for beer or whatever in the car, worried about how they're going to be treated rather than thinking, well, the police officer is going to take their action and go on the way. I think I'm getting off the topic here, but anyway, I think the mindset in police agencies has really changed. Where before, and when I was young, and even when I 20 years ago, when I was a young prosecutor, a lot of the idea was police are there to help you, they're there to serve you. Their first option is to befriend you, to diffuse a situation through language, and I've seen it changing. Of course, that happens still, and there are a lot of good police officers still, but there are a lot more who've taken the us-against-them attitude, where any citizen they encounter is not their neighbor, it's their enemy. And so when somebody's protesting, rather than letting them express their constitutional rights, they, as we saw with all the Occupy movement in the last couple of years, hose them down with pepper spray, or wait till you think nobody's looking and kick him in the head. And I've seen videos of all these things. I just think, unfortunately, a lot of police officers are developing that mindset, and it's a bad way to go.
Now, do you think it's the availability of the military-style equipment and essentially the costuming that they take on through that may be driving that? Or is it some other mentality within the police departments that's driving that change of attitude?
Well, I think it all goes hand in hand. It's hard to say which one sparked it and which things are growing up together and which one's the cause and which one is the result. But I think they're all growing up together. the war on drugs, the militarization of police, and then the general attitude of police rather than helping my friends, keeping peace in my community, to going out into the war zone and finding my enemies and treating everybody I encounter as a suspect rather than assuming the best in them, they assume the worst in them. I'd have to think more, I guess, about what's the cause and what's the effect, but they're certainly all hand in hand.
How do you think that, or what's the ultimate impact you think that that has on the ability of law enforcement agencies to ultimately do what they should be doing, and that is trying to fight crime or solve crimes?
Well, it's got a terrible effect. It's got a hindrance. Police used to count on people in the neighborhood to come to them, say, hey, I think there's a problem in this house over here, or you might want to look at this store, or I've seen this guy hanging around this outside the convenience store. You may want to take a look at him. Citizens don't go to the police anymore because they're afraid to. They're afraid if they go up to them, they're going to get shaken down. So I think it's a major hindrance. You reminded me of another video I saw recently where a police officer in a public housing type situation saw a young boy standing on his curb throwing a football up in the air and catching it himself. Didn't have anybody to play football with. So the officer parked his car and got out, and my first thought at that point was he's going to shake this poor kid down and see if he's got any marijuana in his pocket or something. But he played catch with the kid, and I was just so warmed by that, thinking that's the way it ought to be. Now he's got a kid in the neighborhood who's got a positive thought about a police officer. Maybe they get to know each other's names, and maybe they'll be friends now. And that's the way it ought to be. Instead, that's such a rare thing that most of the kids, if they saw the police officer park his car, they'd take off running, even if they weren't doing anything wrong. And that's terribly wrong.
Thank you very much, Brian. Those are some really good comments. You've been listening to Jaws of Justice Radio on KKFI 90.1 FM. This is Robin Martinez. I'm a lawyer with the Kansas City chapter of the National Lawyers Guild, and we've been talking about militarization of police forces today with Kansas City criminal defense lawyer Brian Leininger. Thank you for being on, Brian.
Thank you very much.
Now, the calendar for February 10th, 2014. Missourians for Alternatives to the Death Penalty has launched a petition aimed at the governor and Board of Probation and Parole asking them to commute Michael Taylor's death sentence to life without parole. Michael, who is scheduled to be executed February 26th, was sentenced without a lawyer by his side, a trial, or a jury convicting him. You can find the petition at madpmo.org/commute Michael's sentence/. MADP is also picketing the Combining Pharmacy in Tulsa, Oklahoma, that is illegally supplying the drug for Michael's execution. If you would like to know more about getting involved, contact Kathleen Burnett at 816-206-8692. Mothers of Incarcerated Sons and Daughters presents the first of its Let the Truth Be Known lecture series with Dr. Christy Griffin, founder and president of the Ethics Project in St. Louis, Missouri. Her talk is entitled Incarceration in Black and White, the Subjugation of Black America. Dr. Griffin will speak at the UMKC Student Center, 5000 Holmes, KCMO, on Thursday, February 20th, from 6 to 8 p.m. This event is open to the public. For directions and parking information, call 816-235-5071. On Friday, February 21st, at 9:15 a.m., Dr. Griffin will be joined by Missouri State Representative Brandon Ellington and KCMO Councilman Michael Brooks at Zion Grove Missionary Baptist Church, 2801 Swope Parkway, KCMO, for what is billed an awakening session. For information on these two events, contact Beverly Livingston at 816-337-5876 or check the MISD website, MISD-KC.com. The KC Metro Reentry Coalition will meet Thursday, February 20th from 9 to 11 a.m. at Pioneer Campus Auditorium, 2700 East 18th Street, KCMO. The speaker will be Ms. Helen Hurley, Field Services Administrator, Missouri Department of Corrections, Division of Probation and Parole. Her topic of discussion is Leadership Courage as a Choice. For information on this and future meetings, contact Ron Smith, Director, Second Chance Program, 816-960-6800, extension 228, or email at rsmith@kc-crime.org. Jaws of Justice Radio wants to thank all of those listeners out there that pledged during the KKFI on-air pledge drive. If you did not get a chance to donate, it is not too late. You can always donate on the KKFI website. That's kkfi.org. My name is Jeff Humfeld, reminding you that these events and more can be found on the Jaws of Justice Radio Facebook page, as well as the Jaws of Justice Radio page on the KKFI website, kkfi.org. And now we will go to Allie and her guest.
This is Allie Catherine Bush, your host today on the program for Jaws of Justice, KKFI 90.1 FM Community Radio. My guest today will talk about the Wyandotte Center Crisis Clinic located in Kansas City, Kansas. And I have four guests today. I'll let each one of them speak and then ask a few questions of each one of them to explain anything further that they want to comment on. My first guest is Julie Solomon. She is the Chief Strategic Officer with Wyandotte Incorporated, the parent company for the program and the partners that are involved in implementing the program. I'll let you speak now, Julie. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for having us here today. We're going to spend a little bit of time talking about really our journey over the last 2.5 to 3 years in Wyandotte County, specific to our initiatives with criminal justice, mental health, and substance abuse intersection. We began looking at best practice standards and research about 3 years ago, and discovered in that the sequential intercept model was being used around the country and around our state of Kansas. That model identifies 5 places to intercept persons who have mental health or substance abuse issues out of the criminal justice system and back into a community-based treatment system. And from that discovery, we ended up having a grant that came through the Gaines Center, and we convened a group of department heads that included our former police chief, Rick Armstrong, our sheriff, Don Ash, and Judge Kate Lynch, who's here with us today, as well as a couple of other judges and individuals representing the treatment organizations in our community. And the Gaines Center consultants took us through this map for our community, looking at where our community was doing a good job with this and where we had system gaps that we needed to improve. Out of that, training. We had started our crisis intervention team training with our law enforcement organizations, and Captain Doug Parisi is here today and will be speaking a little bit about that. Last January, we began a jail diversion program where we have someone from our mental health center and someone from Heartland RADAC, the substance abuse provider, in our jail. And those individuals are cross-checking the daily booking report with our treatment databases to identify individuals who have mental health and or substance abuse issues and have committed low-level crimes, typically nuisance-related crimes, who are being booked in and out of the jail and consequently in and out of our court systems. So that program has been really helpful to us in terms of identifying the number of individuals who we treat in the community who are being engaged in the criminal justice system. From that, we received just this last fall the Bureau of Justice Assistance Grant. That grant is allowing us to expand our crisis center hours through the weekends so that law enforcement has an alternative place to take individuals who meet that criteria instead of jail. And Katie Sanchez is here today, and she will speak a little to what our crisis center does, the services that provides.
Okay. Julie, before I get to Katie, what is the criteria for getting help? How do these people end up, communicating with the Wyandotte Center?
Well, Katie will talk a little bit about how people schedule appointments to come in. But in terms of the criminal justice lens, our goal is to have a 24-hour crisis center that's supposed to be happening. Hopefully in April, our governor just announced that we'll have a redesigned crisis center through the Rainbow, the old Rainbow State Hospital. Mm-hmm. And so we're very excited about the opening of that coming in April, which will provide 24-hour access for our law enforcement and first responders to be able to take individuals rather than jail who are committing low-level crimes. And I think it's really important that we acknowledge that because there are people who have mental health and substance abuse issues who do commit violent crimes, and individuals that do that need to be in a jail or criminal justice system. But the majority of people with mental health issues are nonviolent individuals, and the focus of these programs has been around the individuals who are committing low-level crimes, nonviolent crimes.
Okay. Good morning, Katie. This is Katie Sanchez. She's the service manager of the Emergency and Stabilization Services. So please expand and tell us what your responsibilities are.
Good morning. Thank you for having us. Our crisis services are located right now at 1301 North 47th Street in Kansas City, Kansas. And like Julie had mentioned, we are currently there 7 days a week from 8 a.m. to 8 p.m. We have an array of individuals who are there. I typically have anywhere from 5 to 6 crisis therapists, as well as crisis case managers and attendant care workers who are there to greet individuals who walk in who are experiencing a crisis. And the main focus of that is that individuals get to self-define their crisis. We meet them where they're at and help them to alleviate their crisis. The walk-in process, generally within 5 minutes after walking in our front door, the individual who comes in is going to be greeted by a clinician who will start working with them. Typically, the outcomes of somebody walking in is that we assist them in getting into the hospital if they're a danger to themselves or a danger to others, experiencing an increase in psychiatric symptoms, or if they're self-care failure, then we will assist them in getting into the hospital. We also have an 8-bed crisis stabilization house. So if an individual isn't quite to the point of needing hospitalization, but they maybe just need some extra support, we can allow them to enter our crisis stabilization house, which is staffed 24/7. It's a place where people can go and be safe and have meals and sleep, have their medications offered to them. And the typical length of stay for there is 72 hours, but we continue to assess the need for somebody to stay at the house.
Okay. Would any of these people be homeless and still get the services?
Yes. People can be homeless and they can still receive the services. The important thing to take note of with the crisis stabilization house is in order to go there, you have to be an open client. You have to be open in our system. But that's something else that we can do through Crisis Clinic is we can complete intakes. You can also call and schedule an intake with our outpatient services. We also have a crisis line that's answered 24/7, and that's a good place where people can call and get questions answered and get directed on what the right way to enter our services are.
Okay. Could you give that phone number?
Sure.
Right now?
913-788-4200.
Okay, and if they want further information, background, they can go to your website?
Yes.
And what is that website? Or they could just put in Wyandotte Center Crisis
yes.
Clinic and it would pop up on the
yes.
on the computer. Okay. The next guest I have is Captain Douglas Parisi with the Kansas City, Kansas Police Department. Captain, tell us what some of the services are that you provide.
Good morning, Allie. Thank you for having us. One of the big things at the law enforcement perspective from this is that we're the ones that come in first contact with somebody that's in crisis. And the whole point of getting together with the community approach is to give all officers an alternative to the typical incarceration or booking them into the jail for their behavior. And so by coming together with the community, having the crisis clinic that we can take people to and that we have resources that we can divert people from jail and get them the treatment that they need, that's the number one thing that law enforcement wants to offer. We have the CIT program, the Crisis Intervention Team Program, and the basic point of that is to tell officers that after a situation is stabilized, once you've created a safe environment for everybody, the officers and the person that you're contacting, let's stop and evaluate, slow things down, and find out what's going on and what's the best solution for that person. So out there on the street, a lot of times the officers come across someone that might be experiencing a crisis. They might be trespassing. They might be wandering through community areas. They might be causing other people alarm or concern. And the officers show up, and if they don't have some place to take that person, the person is demonstrating that they're not able to take care of themselves, a lot of times that person ends up in jail. One of the key points of this is to emphasize to officers that the jail is not the place for them. They might get some medicines, but they don't get counseling, they don't get treatment, and it's a cost to taxpayers that would better be spent by finding community programs that are able to meet these people in their homes, have these people come to the clinics, and be under supervision that will get them through their crisis without having the legal system involved.
Okay, so you would be working, too, with Katie Sanchez as far as how long they stay in the program and get the treatments.
Correct. We are just the first responders. We're the first ones out there that see the person in crisis. We then intercept them and hopefully divert them from the jail, get them over to Katie, find out what services the person is in need of. And the best thing for us is with the limited resources within the law enforcement, especially the limited personnel resources, time is valuable when it comes to law enforcement. So when Katie's clinic is able to take the person in crisis and the officer is able to get out of there within 15 or 20 minutes and know that the person's taken care of, then the officer can go on to the next call. And that's the number one focus, because if without that alternative, they end up incarcerated, which is not where we want them.
Okay. All right. I'm going to take a moment here to announce to our listeners that have just tuned in that this is Allie Catherine Bush, host today of this edition of Jaws of Justice, and you're listening to KKFI 90.1 FM Community Radio. I'm going to talk now to Judge, Little Lynch, is that correct?
Yep, Lynch, Judge Kate Lynch.
Kate Lynch, I'm sorry, I'm not reading that correctly. Okay, Judge, I'm going to turn this over to you and let you tell what happens in the legal system once these people that have mental problems or substance abuse problems, how they can avoid not going into the jails. But
where I intersect is when someone won't seek treatment voluntarily and they're a danger to themselves or others, then there is a procedure in the Kansas State statutes where it's called an involuntary commitment or a care and treatment procedure can be filed. Those are filed by our district attorney's office, and many times Katie's personnel sometimes is a petitioner or their family member is the petitioner in that case. And when they come into the courtroom, they are represented by defense counsel, and I have eight attorneys that pretty much volunteer because they're paid about $35 an hour, which that's not the going rate for a good attorney, but they do it as a voluntary service and the community service to the court. And there's a probable cause proceeding, which means I have to find enough reasonable evidence to find that they are suffering from a mental illness, that they're a danger to themselves or others, and they're refusing treatment. At that point, we have to have we send them to the state hospital. It used to be we sent them to Rainbow years ago, but now it's the state hospital, which hopefully we'll go back to sending people to Rainbow. And we bring them back. By statute, it says 2 weeks. We prefer 10 days because we don't want to restrict anyone's liberty any longer than is necessary. And at that point, we have to find by clear and convincing evidence that they are a danger to themselves or others, that they're suffering from a mental illness, and that they're refusing to get treatment. If we find those things, then we have some options. One is what we refer to as outpatient treatment orders. I guess the easiest way to think about that is almost like probation for the mentally ill. My policy has evolved over the last 7 years that I've been in charge of this docket. I now bring the person back within 30 days if they're out of the hospital and on outpatient treatment orders. We do an in-court review, and I always tell the respondents or the patients that I want to make sure that they have all the tools in place so that they can be successful in the community, because not only do they have to make med clinic appointments, they'll have a case manager, they may have traffic tickets over or even misdemeanor tickets over in municipal court, and I work with my partners over in municipal court, the municipal court judges, to make sure that there's communication so that if they're out on outpatient treatment order, some warrant from 2 years ago for trespassing doesn't end up getting placed back in the jail and interrupting their progress and their treatment. And so I'm in pretty much in constant contact with Katie and all of her case managers, and they perform an invaluable service to the court.
Okay, I know that this must cost a lot of money to taxpayers, so this funding is really good to help out with the situations.
I think we have discovered that I think the average inmate in the Wyandotte County Jail, it's $92 a day. And by starting the jail diversion program with Wyandotte Center, we have not only kept people from being admitted, so it's a little difficult to prove a negative, but we know that we have lowered the average days of stay in jail. So we have saved the taxpayers quite a lot of money, and so I think it's appropriate that it's being channeled back into the community to get the patient the appropriate treatment, as opposed to just putting them in the jail and not treating the symptoms that keep returning them to jail.
Okay, on any given day, how many people are over there in the jails? I mean, is there overflow? Is it overcrowding?
On any given day in Wyandotte County, we have approximately 150 people that are farmed out. So those are folks that have been charged with crimes. We couldn't hold them in our own jails, so we've sent them to other communities, and we have to pay those communities for those beds. And I couldn't tell you the exact number of our patients or involuntary commitments that are in and out of the jail, but Julie might have that number.
Know that from our jail diversion program, cross-checking the daily booking report with our Wyandotte Center database, that there's about 50 active clients of the mental health center who are booked into the jail each month. If you back that out by individuals who used to receive services at Wyandotte Center, and if they've fallen out of services over the last 3 years, that number doubles.
I can also tell you that in 2012, we filed 147, I think, care and treatments, and in 2013, we filed 189. Okay. So the number of folks coming through the court system and getting help is rising, but I think that's a good thing because then we're better able to get them treated through the court system as opposed to running them through the jail.
Mm-hmm. The one thing that we have focused on, especially in the CIT class, is to tell the officers there's about 550 people that are incarcerated through Wyandotte County. The jail holds somewhere between about 400 to 425. So we are having to send out, as Judge Lynch mentioned, about 150 people a day that are in other communities. But a third of the Wyandotte County jail population has some diagnosed mental illness or crisis that they're going through, and that is very common nationwide. There's been several articles out of Los Angeles County and Cook County, Illinois, that have documented how much of an expense it is to the law enforcement community and to communities as a whole to pay for the psychotropic meds, to pay for the incarceration of people that are mentally ill, who are there, as Julie mentioned, not really for for violent crimes. These are people that are there for things like vagrancy, disorderly conduct, and trespassing. Those are the people we're trying to target with this approach, to get out of there and to allow the community to help them. As Judge Lentz mentioned, it's a minimum of $92 a day to have someone in the jail. That really doesn't include the medicines and the other costs. That $92 diverted away from the jail and into the community programs would be much better spent helping those people become productive members of society, because that's the other message. Just because they have a mental illness doesn't mean they can't be a productive member of the society.
Okay. Julie, I don't remember if you mentioned the partners that are involved in this program. Could you mention who they are?
Yes, and I'm actually glad to have that opportunity, because the thing that I think all of us would say is that none of this we could do by ourselves. Mm-hmm. We cannot operate in silos and make the kind of progress that is necessary. And so for us, that's probably been the most important and most powerful lesson of this over the last 3 years, is we have had really an amazing partnerships working together. Mm-hmm. And we would not be where we are today without that. So we've had local government officials who have been very supportive of these initiatives. Our police, our former police chief and our current police chief are very supportive. Sheriff Don Ash, the judges, both municipal and district side, have been very supportive. Treatment centers, the Wyandotte Center, Heartland, RADAC, and others. So we have had some very significant partnerships, and the ability to communicate with one another freely has been just critical to us moving forward.
Okay. Does anyone else have any comments you want to make that we haven't covered?
I just wanted to share that we have found the Wyandotte Center website, and that is www.wyandotteinc.org.
Okay. All right. This has been really informative. I hope our listeners have written down those numbers and are able to get in touch with you when necessary. I want to thank all of you for coming today. I'll mention your names again. Julie Solomon, Chief Strategic Officer with Wyandotte Inc. Katie Sanchez, Service Manager of Emergency and Stabilization Services. Captain Douglas Parisi with the Kansas City, Kansas Police Department, and Judge Katie Lynch. Thank you so much for coming on the show today, and please contact us again with any further information about your successes. Thank you for coming in today.
Thank you for having
us.
Thank you.
Ready? 1, 2, 3. Am I gonna make it?
some way, somehow. Well, maybe I'm not supposed to know. Maybe I'm supposed to cry. If nobody ever knows the way I feel, that's all right.
We hope you enjoyed today's show and that we leave you with something to think about, something to talk to your neighbors about, and a reason to get involved. As always, the opinions expressed are those of the hosts and guests of Jaws of Justice Radio, not of KKFI, the Midcoast Radio Project Incorporated, its staff, or volunteers. You can find our calendar of events and a link to our show episodes and podcasts on the Jaws of Justice Radio Facebook page. If you have a show idea or want to help produce the show, email us at jawsofjusticeradio@yahoo.com. And you can always listen to us live on the KKFI website, kkfi.org. We thank our engineer Mike Murphy, host of the Wednesday Morning Buzz. Please tune in for the rest of our 9 a.m. weekday lineup with Law and Disorder on Tuesday, Alternative Radio on Wednesday, Tell Somebody with Tom Clemmer on Thursday, and Between the Lines at 9 a.m., followed by Bioneers at 9:30 a.m. on Friday. Up next is Beautician's Blues with Luscious Lynn, and at noon, Arts Magazine with Michael Hoag. Stick around for Jazz and Blues in the afternoon and Echo Radio KC at 6 p.m. Then round out your day with the spicy Latin sounds of Sabor Latino and Fiesta Musical.
It's the 420 Drug War News.
Diane Goldstein. I'm a speaker and a board member for Law Enforcement Against Prohibition.
Diane, you're also what I would call an activist. You're not just speaking about the war on drugs necessarily. You're talking about human rights. You're talking about medical necessity. You're talking about dignity. Is that right?
Well, it's very interesting. Is I think one of the things that we're seeing is as we move further and further away from drug prohibition, one of the most compelling reasons to move away from it is that it violates human rights. And not just here in America, but across the world, if you look at the forced internment camps that the UN did a newspaper article about last year, there's a critical link that the more we prohibit a substance and we use coercive means to try to be drug-free in whatever capacity, it does violate human rights. Very specifically around marijuana, I think that drug prohibition itself is much more dangerous to our children and to other people who responsibly use marijuana, whether it's for medical purposes or for adult recreational purposes. The violence associated with the black market, the collateral consequences that surround what happens to people after you come into contact with law enforcement, it's those things that are very, very compelling and really clearly the reason that we need to bring our drug policy under a public health model, but not to do it in the sense of drug courts or coercive rehabilitation, but taking much more of the route that Portugal or other countries have done.
And I've seen news breaking up in the Northeast that they had a recent outbreak of overdoses from heroin that was, and I won't say cut, but mixed with fentanyl. They say it's 20 times stronger than heroin. This is a direct result of the black market of prohibition itself. Am I right?
Absolutely. You're 100% correct on that. And so what we see and what we have seen traditionally in the past, kids would go to their local marijuana dealer, and in fact they would become addicted because the day that there was not marijuana available, that drug dealer had a much more harder substance that was much more addictive. And so by controlling and regulating the market, we take the criminals out of it.
That was Diane Goldstein of Law Enforcement Against Prohibition. They're out there on the web. Please check them out at leap.cc. Dean Becker, drugtruth.net.